Welcome to Stargate SG Fun, a podcast where we discuss episodes of the original Stargate series, and sometimes we talk a lot about episodes, and sometimes a little less about them, but we have fun critiquing and reminiscing and analyzing from a new perspective. I am Trishy Mattson.
I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub, a dog of Midgard.
And today, we are joined by a guest, Eric, from the Incomparable Slack. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your interest in science fiction, and particularly in Stargate?
Sure. First, thanks for having me on. I guess I've always been a sci-fi fantasy fan, lover, nerd, geek, whatever you want to call me, from as long as I can remember. Got involved in the Incomparable and podcasting back, probably in the high single digits of the Incomparable podcast way back when. As far as Stargate goes, I saw the original back in the theaters back in 94. I like the concept that they went with the theory that the Egyptian pyramids were built by aliens. So I loved how they ran with that idea and made the Egyptian gods, quote unquote, actual space aliens. And then I, you know, saw the movie, forgot all about it. Years later, I read somewhere that there's going to be a TV series on Showtime, which was great, but I didn't have any pay channels back then, so I didn't really think much about that either. Then when I was watching like the Sci-Fi Channel, I think that's when they started doing reruns of the Showtime shows back in, I guess, the late 90s. And then I guess Showtime stopped making them, and then Sci-Fi bought it up and ran with it. So pretty much from that point forward, I've been watching Stargate, SG-1, Atlantis, Stargate Universe, all the movies. I don't think I saw them all back when they were on Sci-Fi Channel. So a couple years ago, I had done like a targeted rewatch of SG-1. I had found a webpage on Richard Dean Anderson's website that had listed like all the major story arcs throughout the entire 10 seasons. And like, you know, the NID, the Gould, you know, the four ways you can pronounce that. You know.
Beware of spoilers, because we have to be careful about that.
That's why I stopped it there, because you've heard about those two groups before, so I'm not going to go any further. So I watched like the pivotal episodes of those story arcs last year when we're all kind of sitting at home doing nothing because of the pandemic. I watched Atlantis and Stargate Universe the same way. I probably love Stargate more than most shows, and the ones I really get involved in kind of have these same themes where there's really good characters, really good character development. It's an interesting concept in general, and they have an interesting and coherent and consistent world most of the time. I love world building. I'm the kind of geek that buys role-playing game books, not because I'm ever going to play the game, but just because I want to read about the background and the history and the world. And so I've got tons of books I'll never play.
You know, there's a Stargate role-playing game that they just actually came out with, right?
Yeah, I backed the Kickstarter.
Of course you did.
And I tried to help edit the book when they gave us a draft, but I was just too interested in reading it than actually commenting on it. So, but obviously then they have to have good stories to wrap up all those two things together. And, you know, the Stargate franchise certainly has all that. I love how the characters interact with each other, as we'll see in a couple of these shows. They have good supporting characters, you know, the world concept, the world building that they have with the, you know, aliens being Earth culture gods. I love that idea. And there's obviously been 200 plus shows of great stories over the last, you know, however long it's been, 10, 15 years of all the shows together. So I still love watching them. I still remember a handful of them after all this time. So it stuck in my head and I love watching and talking about it. So I'm glad I'm here.
That's great. Okay. So today we're going to do two shallow dives and two deep dives. We'll be starting out with season 2, episode 5, Need. And I'll give the recap this time.
Before you do the recap, I just wanted to say how this was an interesting set of episodes. I watched 3 of them.
Yeah.
Not Message in a Bottle. And I now understand why you wanted me to watch Need. I thought it was really interesting because these episodes work really well together because they're all correcting mistakes and consequences of the previous season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I really quite liked that. So let's go through with Need and we'll see how that sort of plays out.
Sure thing. Okay. As Jack O'Neill reports to Hammond, we had a nice time, Carter got some Naquita, Teal'c made some friends, Daniel got engaged. I'm going to hit the showers. I'll give a slightly longer recap than that. Daniel stops a princess from committing suicide, and then the team gets sent to work in the Naquita mines. Daniel is hurt in an escape attempt. Shyla, the princess, puts him in a sarcophagus. Rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. He feels great and doesn't need glasses anymore, while the rest of the team gets dirtier and hungrier and more exhausted.
Crankier.
Carter has visions from Jolinar about sarcophagi turning you evil. After getting addicted to the sarcophagus, Daniel gets engaged to Shyla, but he and the team are allowed to return to Earth so he can tie up loose ends. Daniel is kept in the infirmary, goes into withdrawal, tries to escape, points a gun at Jack, who says, "I know what this is like," and talks him down. They hug and cry. SG-1 returns and tells Shyla, or Daniel tells Shyla, "You don't have to do this alone," and she uses a staff weapon to destroy the sarcophagus, once again setting us almost back to where we were before we started.
This is a strange episode in that this is one of those episodes which Andrew told me not to watch and Trish told me to watch, and I can see why. I asked the question in the previous podcast about how many times we had seen Jackson go through a sarcophagus, and that nicely coincides with this episode. We also have had the problem that sarcophaguses show up and then they're major plot devices, so maybe they just felt the need to turn them down a notch and depower them a little bit, which I thought was a bit silly, but okay. This is the most poorly paced episode of Stargate I have yet to watch. But let's hear what everyone else has to say.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Eric, why don't you start?
Sure. I mean, I made a couple notes because we were going to do a deep dive on this. But yeah, I love, again, like the interplay of the characters when, you know, the three of them are working hard and starving to death in the mines. And Daniel's just walking in all dressed up and clean and like, "Hey, I'm going to have a feast tonight." And, you know, O'Neill's looking at Daniel like, "You've got to be blanking kidding me." Like, it's like, if I wasn't shackled, I would strangle you right now. So I love that. Also, I love Michael Shank's performance in this as both becoming the addict and like the overconfident evil.
Oh, yeah.
Having it affect his personality. And then obviously the withdrawal part at the end, which I'm guessing actors must love diving into those kind of things because they can just really get into it and act, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only other two other things I had noted was, I guess in 700 years that this former slave who is now running the place, I guess the goal never sent anybody to check on the planet. As long as the Nakodo was flowing, we're good.
Apparently, they think that whatever Gould originally ruled that planet is still there and just doesn't feel like talking to anybody. But yeah, as long as what they think is the Gould keeps sending that stuff back through, no need to go check in on them. They all have their own private paradises and wars and stuff to worry about.
Yeah. And I guess at the end, I thought Shyla kind of, you know, rushed to destroy the sarcophagus. Like, Daniel's like, "Yeah, it's bad. Okay." But, you know, it's only a few minutes left in the show. So, you know, just shortcuts, you know. So.
always a problem, yeah.
Yes. Well, I really enjoy Daniel in this episode. I particularly like where, as you say, he strolls in with the clean, beautiful robes, and he's talking about how great he feels while they look so terrible. And Jack reminds him, "What about getting us out?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah. It's all good. That's all in train. I'm working on them." And he says, "Look, I don't need glasses anymore," as he talks with his crazy eyes.
Well, what's funny is, right, that actually works. Jackson's plan to wait until she's confident about him, and then she'll let everybody go. For all the back and forth and drama about it, that's all that happens. Watching it again was kind of, there wasn't really a twist. The twist was that it all just kind of worked.
Well, she waited to let them back until she had gotten Daniel
hooked,
thoroughly addicted.
Yes. She's a bad person.
She's a drug dealer. Of course she's bad.
Yeah, she did this deliberately. It's kind of funny, right? Because she has to be somewhat sympathetic for this to work.
Mm-hmm.
But there are definitely several points in this thing where it's like, yeah, it's very clear that she's like, "No, my plan is to get him hooked and then make it that he has to come back. And then, you know, and then let everybody go. But I'm only going to let people go. I'm only going to let people out of that mine once I've got an unfair advantage." Very clear that she does it on purpose. It's just funny.
As an after-school special about why drugs are bad, this episode works. It's just, it doesn't work much more than that. And that's okay.
Just say no to sarcophagi, right? Yeah.
The other thing that's funny is that when Daniel, I think it's Daniel, kind of says, "Well, we can help them with the mining." When you think about it, like, clearly, you know, he's talking about using modern mining techniques on this planet. And, like, modern mining techniques really suck. Like, you know, mountaintop removal, fracking, you know, just all this horrible things that they would have to do to this planet to extract more Nakoda. And I'm like, you're not really helping him that much, I don't think, actually.
I guess he could be talking about basic safety equipment and power drills.
Could be.
It's just the big hammers, you have better drills, you know.
Mining doesn't have to be as unsafe and dangerous as it generally is made to do for profits here.
Explosives, you know, which probably might be bad with Nakoda. I don't know, but, you know.
Yeah, that's a point. So that is a fun episode, but there's not a huge amount to discuss there. I just one side note, since Jack says, I know what this is. I know how you feel and what you're going through. I know what this is like. I think it's pretty clear that Jack has had his own addiction issues, which we sort of knew before. I mean, and it's probably alcohol, not anything illegal, but still an interesting side note on that. I do like that the men in this show are occasionally allowed to be vulnerable and talk about their struggles and even cry.
I don't know. I kind of interpreted that O'Neill always has to be able to tell Jackson that he's done it, but he's had it worse. For whatever happens to Jackson.
Yeah, no, it did occur to me that I was wondering if that was the alcohol that was shown in the movie. I also thought, I kind of rolled my eyes, like, the big climactic battle of this episode is in a closet. That kind of sums up the episode for me, yeah.
But I kind of enjoyed that. You know, this was certainly a different episode than a lot of others.
Yeah.
All right, we'll move on.
All right.
So next we're going to talk in a bit more detail about season 2, episode 6, Thor's Chariot. And David, I believe you have the recap for this one.
An off-world gate activation is a message from Samira. Send more help. An SGC probe discovers the Goa'uld have attacked. SG-1, really, just 4 people, go to save Samaria because they broke it. They meet Garwin, find that Kendra was killed, and Sam can now use Goa'uld tech. O'Neill and Teal'c fight off the Goa'uld Heru'urs Jaffa, while Jackson and Carter go find the Hall of Thor's Might, solving some questionable challenges. They briefly meet a somewhat diminutive Thor, who later shows up at the end to deus ex machina the Goa'uld away, but Heru'ur escapes through the gate. Apparently, SG-1 are still too young.
David, I'm in awe of how many things you can mispronounce in one summary of things.
It is a gift. It is a gift.
Yeah, Samaria, Heru'ur. There you go. And Goa'uld, well, we're just going to give up on Goa'uld. That's just, no one can pronounce that.
Yep. This podcast is definitely a test.
We're going back to Chulak, so that's also going to be fun.
Oh.
So, yeah, but we get to interact with the Asgard again, actually for the first time.
Yay, my favorite aliens.
I'm very happy to have seen them. I believe I knew that what the Asgardians looked like, but I wasn't quite sure if I remembered who Thor was, because I think they only show up in one episode of Atlantis or something like that. So it was always this sort of unknown of, is this exactly what the show does or not? And this was still a little bit of a surprise. It was still pretty cool. The one question I do have before we get into this episode is, does that mean, or is the show trying to imply that the Ra we saw attacking Earth was in the body of an Asgardian or not? Because it kind of looked a little bit like an Asgardian in the flashbacks in the movie. So I don't know. I'm still watching.
I mean, do you want us to answer that or do you want us to not answer that?
No, I'm just asking the question. You're not allowed to answer it.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, so moving on. No, just kidding. So we get to this thing where we see the result of the team's ill-advised actions before. And so that's good, right? And I think I enjoyed that when I was first watching the show, when it first came out, this idea that there's going to be continuity, that there's going to be effects of things that you do, and that the team does take a certain amount of responsibility for the things that they've done. So I really loved that, I think, when I first saw this episode going through. And I think it's a good basis for another episode. What did other people think?
Well, I agree with you that it's good. That is one of the interesting things about this show, is that while it resets a lot of things to zero every episode, we do get progressions of things, and this was definitely an interesting consequence, one that David rightly predicted when we discussed the first Thor episode, that, you know, destroying Thor's hammer may not have been a completely great idea. There are a lot of fun things about this episode. One other thing is that we continue the idea we just saw in Need, that there are some remnants of memory or something that Jolinar of Moksha, the Tok'ra that briefly inhabited Carter, is not completely gone. So we see here that she can activate at least the hand device, and probably will be able to do more with gold devices as time progresses.
She has the memories of Jolinar of Moksha in exactly as much as is needed by the plot.
We're at the point of storytelling now where it's not fully serialized, but at least they are referencing what happened before to some degree. You can still come in mostly cold if you hadn't seen the show before and kind of get what's going on, but they do drop hints or, oh yeah, remember the time when So I like that part where it's the constant world building and constant evolving and the characters aren't static from episode to episode.
When this may be the first new introduction of a Goa'uld in a while and possibly ever. Like if we ever seen, like we've seen Apophis and we've seen Corel and we've seen whatever, what's her face turned into, but I'm not sure we've actually seen in person another Goa'uld. Oh, we've seen Hathor, right? Because Hathor came in.
Right.
But other than that, this might be the first major Goa'uld we've seen. And of course, the hard to pronounce Harrower. The other interesting thing we've seen is this is the first appearance in the show of what we now know are called the Horus Guards, the guards with the bird beak armor instead of the serpent armor. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of fun. It does also, though, mean that we're seeing them in the same fashion as the serpent guards, which is sort of the less fancy way that the show has of portraying things rather than the movie. So it's not that the Horus Guards were, like in the movie where they were this extremely fancy, white, clean, very high-tech thing. This is more of the one-piece armor thing that of the same style as the Serpent Guard. I like that they translated it, again, pretty well for the show to see these.
I laughed out loud when the Horus Guard disassembles their helmet off screen and you just get the sound effect and then you go back to them and then there's no helmet anymore. Right? That was pretty funny. Like, we cannot afford to do that.
Yeah, there's no mechanical way to make that happen.
Tell not show.
That it looks at all good.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in the middle of my sci-fi show, a D&D adventure broke out. So I thought that was nice. You have a typical D&D quest that they go on in the middle of everything.
They do split the party.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I had not seen this one in a while. I had forgotten about why they had that stupid bridge thing that they had to get across. And I'm like, what is that possibly showing about the ability of people to be valid for Thor? And like, nope, that wasn't why they did it.
The question I had was, well, if they could just all walk across it, no problem, or jump across it, what does that show then? I had the same question. It's like, because in this specific situation, one person fell and someone else had to risk their life, like, that's nice, but maybe they just walked across it and it wasn't that big a deal.
And if it was just one person, there wouldn't really be any way to demonstrate selflessness.
Right. And then for some reason, the solution or the reason why we're advanced enough in society or as a culture is always pie. Every TV series, every show, like Doctor Who did it, other things have done it, it's always pie. That somehow means we have evolved enough to be worthy. I don't know why.
Okay, are we getting into pie?
I am really unconvinced that shows wisdom in a society. That's definitely an int stat, not a wisdom stat.
To continue with the D&D theme, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
I have to dig a little bit into the second challenge. Let's just do this. This is fun. I actually was doing some research into Elder Futhark. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce anything, of course, because that is the script that they're showing. I thought it was really funny going into this because I was doing it beside my 9-year-old son who was telling me what some of the runes mean because they're the same runes with the same meanings used in one of the books that he's currently reading. So that was kind of funny. I thought the puzzle was interesting. The fact that it's pie is ridiculous, but that's not the most ridiculous thing because the people making the show, they did some research. They wanted the symbols to basically be the cardinal numbers of the alphabet mattering something. And the first do. The first two symbols they have are actually the 3rd and the 14th. The second ones, however, are the 19th and the 5th, not the 15th and the 9th.
Yeah.
Because they really wanted ride and horse to be in the script because the script had it. But I'm sure they figured out that they could have the 3rd, the 14th, the 9th, and the 5th. On the wall, if they wanted to, they just probably decided that ride and journey was and horse was more important. That's fine. The idea of taking the cardinal numbers, turning them into decimal digits, ramming them into a decimal number, and have that mean something, that is a leap that is truly unbelievable. That was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, if someone just says it out loud, it kind of works, but there's a lot of presumptions in there. But the funniest part, which I think is kind of inconsequential, but hey, I laugh at the funniest things, is when they go and they actually draw the symbol on the circle, they draw and say that it is the radius. And it is not the radius, it is the diameter. They should have drawn the entire diameter of the circle. But anyway, I think that's as far as I'm going to go onto my little linguistic and mathematical journey. It was fun. I'm curious to see how much they continue to use the way that our modern society interprets these symbols And of course, this language is, as far as we know, only about 2,000 years old, but that's not a surprise. This was fun.
Yay.
Well, while we're talking about language and history, I will proceed on to mythology. First of all, we get the accusation by Olaf that Thor abandoned Sumeria because of Stargate's evil in destroying Thor's hammer, and they argue with him for a little bit. Then later, when after Daniel and Carter have told Jack what they've heard about Thor's hall, Jack dismisses it as mythology. And really, Jack should know better.
He really should.
They quickly list some reasons why other myths have turned into things worth investigating, but he should know better. I guess we need it for plot reasons and for an audience perspective, but really, Jack.
I have it in my notes. There's a time and place for mythology. Yes, O'Neill, this show is the time and place for mythology.
It's right there in the title.
Yeah, well, and they needed a B-plot with, O'Neill and Teal'c sort of fighting the Goa'uld, which, it's always funny just like how few shots they can get away with to take down basically what is an armored enemy soldier. And presumably they did that so they could use the fewest squibs on their body so that they wouldn't have to pay so much for their special effect budget. But, they do all this fighting, but it doesn't really matter that much because they're overcome anyway. The important part of that part of the battle is that they can't win and they have to surrender themselves to it. And another thing that's always funny about the show is when they do surrender, like they're basically taken by the guards and they're just walked along a path. No, like handcuffs, no nothing.
Really?
When Thor's ship does appear, the guards look all scared and SG-1 just kind of looks around like, whatever. And it's just, they don't really act much like they're in danger in this show when they're captured, because they're not. But it's kind of funny how that all works. But, the important part is that they did the quote-unquote right thing by sacrificing themselves for the sake of the village, of the planet, I guess, whatever, this area. And like Teal'c said in somewhere in the middle of the episode, no, I will stay until the Goa'uld have been promising to just, be part of your battle as long as it takes, which would have been difficult for the show's continuity if he had actually stayed for years and years. But luckily, they didn't have to do that.
Going back to that responsibility thing, I liked toward the very beginning of the episode where SG-1 is trying to convince Hammond to let them go back and clean up their mistake. Jack says he gave the order to destroy Thor's hammer. Daniel says he actually shot the staff weapon. Teal'c says it's his fault because he was the one trapped in that thing anyway. And Carter says, I was there.
Good laugh line.
Yes.
Well, because they'd have all four of them go through the gate to help, because just three of them would be ridiculous. They'd be outnumbered.
The team would be off balance that way.
Right.
They need the four that they've all gotten so used to working with each other.
I appreciate the consequence. I appreciate that this episode is a consequence of the previous episode. On the other hand, I still don't understand why Thor's hammer was any help against an orbital invasion.
Yeah, no, that is true.
And that aspect just never really made any sense to me, and this episode kind of glossed over it. And they kind of implied that a pyramid ship had already arrived, but then they implied that they are building up the landing pads for the pyramid ship, because apparently you can only land a pyramid ship on a planet that has a pyramid. So there's aspects of why this was the consequence of their action was a little strange to me, but it holds together as being an important consequence.
Yeah, I was confused a little bit in the middle as to whether the ships had arrived or, but O'Neill goes on a little bit about, oh, if we use RC4 to destroy the landing pads and then the ships show up. Yeah, I mean, in the end, it was just kind of talk that was needed to fill up the episode while they got onto the more important things. But yeah, I also think it's funny. I discussed this before that, the idea that pyramids are landing pads for spaceships, like that's not just this show. They didn't make that up. Like that is a real world belief that some people have, mm-hmm. that the pyramids are actually.
It fits with the mythology, definitely.
Yeah. And it's, it is sort of funny that thing, that real world belief, which is obviously false and derogatory towards Middle Eastern cultures, is a basis of how everything works in this fantasy world. Always gives me a chuckle. The fact that they have to come back, they have to try to fix this thing, and they can't, completely unable to fix this thing, but they are able to get the attention of the people who actually can, does move things along further, not just in terms of, the guilt or innocence of SG-1, but also of the mythology of things, because we do finally see the Asgard, but their ships. We get to find out that they're a civilization that exists currently. It's not just some ancient gods that have gone away. They're still around. They're still active. And they are there to sort of help. And they're at war with the Goa'uld. These are all things that we would not have known if SG-1 hadn't been done some really ill-advised things.
The Asgard are probably one of my favorite aliens in the series. And I just love the idea that you know, these big, burly, strong, tall, bearded Norse gods are really spindly, little, tiny, small, frail aliens who are hairless with big eyes. And it's hilarious.
Yes, very, very enjoyable. They obviously appeared to the Norse people in a form that they could understand. I do enjoy how Thor's characteristic terseness and condescension moves the plot again, because once he understands the situation, he does not stop to explain anything. He just beams SG-1 back to the planet, keeps Gerwyn so that she can deliver a message later, and proceeds to lay waste to the Gould who are there without, you know, explaining anything. And so once they get to that point, that plot just moves right along.
And one thing I do know about this universe and from the other shows is I think the writers of this show had watched Star Trek and asked the question, why aren't teleporters amazing weapons?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a pretty glorious use of what looks like transporter tech as weapon. It is pretty impressive.
Yep, just beam them up and delete your buffer.
Yeah, because they went somewhere. Where'd they go?
Did they? Whatever.
I don't know. Who knows? It doesn't matter, but who knows? Yeah.
That final shot of Herwer like getting away in the only way he possibly could have if he didn't, his ships weren't there yet and forces were being completely destroyed. Like, nope, I'm just leaving through the Stargate and get away.
It was the perfect villain exit. My favorite part of the previous Thor episode was we got this burly Thor talking like a technocrat in the hologram where it was entirely out of place. And now we get to see Thor and he now looks a little more like the technocrat he sounds like.
Yep.
I just really quite liked it. And I think the effects and the creature work they did really quite work well. So I'm really quite happy with this final reveal so I can be more understanding of the state of Thor. And I'm assuming we're definitely going to see more of the Asgardians. I was amazed at the line. They're going to, I think, leave an Asgardian on this planet to help teach the people.
Yeah. How's that going to work?
That was a surprising line.
Yeah. The writers probably felt like they needed to have the Asgard do something since basically the whole planet was wrecked by SG-1's thing and then the Gould coming back. Like, you can't just leave the planet wrecked and still be the good guys. So they had to do something, but yeah.
Maybe they figured at this point they needed to kind of repair some of the cultural cross-contamination that SG-1 had left behind.
And I guess the jig's up now. They know what they look like, so okay, you know.
It's nice. It's nice world building. It works, and it comes off as pragmatic.
Yep.
And pragmatic world building isn't sometimes the best world building.
Yeah. Just a couple more touches that I enjoyed were when they were doing the riddle and Daniel said, I just don't know. And the Thor hologram appears and says, there is no shame. And Daniel's like, wait.
Hit the pause button. Hit the pause button.
Up yet.
Yep. Yeah, that was good.
The fact that the hologram agreed and just paused for him, I thought was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Yes. And then later when Carter is trying to explain to Gerwyn that, you know, okay, this is just another hologram. This isn't going to respond to us. And the hologram says, well, actually, yes, I am listening. Those were some fun moments there.
And the new Thor's hammer is Teal'c friendly, whatever that means. So.
Yes. And then, of course, I love at the end of the episode where Thor, as David mentioned in the recap, tells SG-1 that, like the Sumerians, you are still much too young. And just Daniel and Carter smirked at each other. It was pretty funny, their expressions.
The whole team, I think, is pretty happy, I guess, about that. They're fond.
They're used to it at this point.
Yeah. And they probably agree with him at this point. I mean, they are little kids, right? Like, they touched the stove.
They broke something.
They broke somebody else's toy. They definitely acted like little kids. So a couple other things that are not Asgard related. They do say in an early line that Kendra has been killed, I believe. So we're not going to see that actress anymore in the show. I did like the reappearance of the personal shield.
Mm-hmm.
This time Herwer has on.
Yes.
Nicely done.
To use to. And then I also like, though, that so Teal'c was confronting Herwer. And so Herwer, hey, you can't shoot me. But then Teal'c shoots his staff weapon so that he can't actually shoot at them as they're escaping.
Right.
And I like that. I like that. That was, you know, a nice little bit of tactical or whatever you would call it. Battle awareness to be able to do that when they're getting away.
Yeah.
Though I do wonder why everyone else didn't arm themselves with staff weapons. There's always this question in this show is why is Teal'c the only good guy ever using a staff weapon?
I mean, the guns help. The guns do work against Jaffa, even armored Jaffa.
Sure, but the locals could have been picking up the staff weapons too.
Well, that's true. Well, Ian, there was definitely like, that one guy that follows them around who's kind of the...
Olaf.
Well, he's kind of the comic relief in this episode, right? Like, so there's that one point where he throws his axe to get one of the Jaffa who's behind SG-1. And I was thinking during that episode, wait, go get your axe. Wait, don't just follow SG-1. Go get your axe. He seems uniquely not really very helpful in most respects in this battle, even though he's supposed to be a hardened warrior. But, you know...
I want to give a quick call out to Hammond. He plays the devil's advocate role well, and I think I quite like they use him basically to allow everyone to give themselves a as-you-know-Bob moment.
Yep.
And it's a really nice touch, as in he's the person who's just going to try and make sure that this is really the wise plan. So he's going to say some stupid things so the audiences can fully understand what's going on, but it works and it comes off as realistic to the character. So I thought it was very nicely done as a mechanism of dropping some knowledge on the audience.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably more realistic arguments he could have made about this, that, like, you know, again, endangering his star pupils, his star team, for the sake of something which does not necessarily affect them. Like, we know how it all came to good with knowing the Asgard a little better, but, you know, there was a really good chance that they would all have just been killed by the Gold.
Well, it's unclear why they don't send, like, 10 platoons, or whatever you'd like to call them, through the gate.
Yeah.
Sending 4 people is just sort of silly, but what do you do?
Or, like, drones, like a bunch of drones. Yeah. Yeah.
I had one small Stargate science thing I wanted to do,
okay.
Which is I quite liked them sending the LARP to make sure everything was okay. But I think this is the first time we've seen them have bi-directional real-time control of the probe on this side. And it is, I think, more realistic to the science that they've shown us that the commands going back and forth, I believe that they would work because for some reason, if this wormhole is up, the Stargate clearly just bridges radio signals across the wormhole.
Yeah.
But it should have been the delay of travel to the other place. That the wormhole should have taken some time, not giving the instantaneous action. But shows have to speed things up sometimes.
You're right. There should have been at least a few seconds pause as long as we get for the... as they go through the Stargate. Oh, well.
This was a great episode. I was very happy with it. It was good fun. Lots of fun dialogue. At this point, every time Thor shows up, I'm happy.
Eric, any final thoughts?
No, I agree. This is one of the good ones that I remember years later and like watching again. My only little quibble with SGC's tactics in the beginning is every time there's an unscheduled off-world activation, they have like a couple guys in the guard in the gate room with guns standing right in front of the Stargate. I'm like, and at least as we'll see later in Family, they do kind of beef that up a little bit and have like some gun turrets on the side and like some missiles apparently at the back. I don't know where they came from. But yeah, it always strikes me as odd of like, you're right in front of where they're coming from. But hey, sure. Other than that, great episode. I love it.
All right. Moving on to the next A Real Bottle episode. We have Season 2, Episode 7, Message in a Bottle.
Yes.
Andrew, I think you're on this one.
I'm on deck. Mm-hmm. The team finds an energy-emitting artifact on a dead world and stupidly decides to bring it back, because that's what they do. So the artifact spreads an alien life form through the base's walls and computer systems and people. And eventually triggers the base's self-destruct countdown, because of course, Jackson thinks that it's communicating, so they feed it energy to grow even faster, and eventually they negotiate with an alien-possessed O'Neill to send the artifact to a primordial world where it can grow without threatening Earth. So they open the gate and chuck the artifact through it, and turn off the auto-destruct with less than a second to spare.
As always.
This is another Richard Dean Anderson plays an alien type of episodes, and those are always fun. There's some nice O'Neill Teal'c scenes, including the phrase, undomesticated equines could not remove me. That might have been the best phrase in the episode. There's also a nice team scene at the end where they all kind of comfort each other after disaster has been averted, which I thought was a nice little, no dialogue really, but nice little team building moment. On the other hand, the alien isn't really all that interesting. And I think we've actually already seen other aliens in this show in like less than 2 seasons where the alien has to take over a person in order to communicate. So even that is something that they've already done, I believe. The crisis is entirely of their own making, so it's hard for me to care very much about it. And of course, there are no long-term ramifications, which is one reason why this is a shallow dive instead of a deep dive. So I think that's pretty much all I have to say about Message in a Bottle.
I didn't see it, but I think I've already seen this Star Trek The Next Generation episode, so that's okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. This is your usual, it's a harmless thing in the beginning.
Yeah.
It seemingly becomes hostile, but turns out it was all just a misunderstanding, and they're all friendly, or at least neutral, and we're all happy fine at the end.
Yeah, and Carter says something along the lines of, maybe we should have tried communicating with it instead of just assuming that it was an infectious disease. But really, that was the smart way to bet. Also, I always enjoy any episode where we see some Dr. Janet Frazier, even though her main function was to beg to open the base so she could get more antibiotics and get denied. But, oh well, still nice to see her.
Yeah, and that's sort of a nice sort of Hammond moment as well, because he's normally such a softy with the SG-1, but for Frazier, nope, you're not getting any dispensations from me.
Right, well, generally, I'm in favor of not breaking quarantines, right. And yeah. This was a very reasonable quarantine, so yeah. I have to vote with Hammond on this case.
But it is, you know, he puts his foot down, but in a way that's not hostile.
Right.
I've liked him throughout the series, and I think he does a nice job here as well, yeah. And again, Richard Dean Anderson sort of emoting, that's kind of all you could say. You know, he gets to do it again.
Yep.
Yeah. And Tuke makes a joke, right?
He does. Yep.
So I think that might be the first time he's explicitly made a joke in the series. Too bad it wasn't a better joke, but you know, he's baby steps.
He's trying.
Yep. Alrighty then. Season 2, Episode 8, Family, is next. And let's hear about it from David.
We'll see if I can pronounce anyone's name right. Retak arrives with news of Poffus' survival and Rayak's capture. SG-1 returns to another rescue on Chulak. Drayuk has married Frotak, but Teal'c is blaming everyone else. Drama, drama, drama. Frotak betrays them, so O'Neill has to kill him. Teal'c continues to be wrong when the team too easily rescues Rayak. SG-1 returns to Earth with Drayuk and Teal'c. Drayuk notices surprise pandemic teeth, but they're removed before Rayuk can kill everyone. Teal'c fails to talk his child out of being horrible, but unlike O'Neill's son, being shot by his father's gun saves Rayuk. Finally, we get the ending Bloodlines should have had.
Yes.
Sorry.
For the record, Rayuk, Braytek, I think it's Drayuk. I think you got that one right. And Frotak, I don't know what's up with that. Sounds like a yogurt.
I had just watched The Incredibles a couple weeks ago, so I kept thinking Frozone. It was just, I'm sorry. I don't know why. I apologize.
Yes, these episodes are covering conflicts and consequences of previous episodes, but considering in our last podcast about Bloodlines, we considered all of them entirely the team's own doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's very hard to have sympathy for the mess this is in and how horribly Teal'c behaves during this episode.
Yep.
Yes, I was struck by how grudgingly he promised not to take his revenge on his wife moving on with his best friend.
After being abandoned twice.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Moving on for very good reasons.
Yeah. But on the other hand, so all the reasoning is pretty bad here, but I did like this episode much better than Bloodlines. And I was a little surprised because when I was thinking about it before, I was like, this is probably going to be about the same as Bloodlines. I did think they did a lot better, like the moments between the characters felt better. The drama, Braytek and Teal'c talking, I thought those were some nice scenes. And even Teal'c talking with Drayuk. I just felt that I had a better time with these characters than I did previously when they were doing it. And some of that might have been because they did the right thing in the end. But some of that I think is also that I think maybe a little bit of written, I think. The scenes might have been better written. I don't know. I liked it more.
This is absolutely a much better version of Bloodlines.
Yeah.
In fact, they probably should have figured out a way of making this Bloodlines and not have Bloodlines at all.
Right.
So I did wonder about Frotak. Was he a baddie all along?
Right.
But I think that actually, because he could have turned in the team or tried to much earlier than he did. And so my suspicion is that he somehow overheard Teal'c getting Drayuk to admit that she didn't love Frotak, and that's when he decided to turn them.
Frotak saw the kiss. That's the drama.
But that's also kind of bad, right?
So bad.
Yep.
Wow, like he's known this guy most of his life, and yet he turns around and becomes a Poffus apologist, immediately after that. Yeah, it's not great.
And gets himself killed almost pointlessly. Like, he could have just shut up at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Like, he could have pretended that, like, no, something, but, he tried to attack O'Neill with a knife, which seems like a really bad idea. Yeah. I tell myself that wasn't the focus of the episode. Like, the focus of the episode was still the major characters, not Frotak. Frotak was a plot device to get things to happen.
Yep.
So I also loved the settings And by loved, I don't really mean loved, but kind of, you know, the scenes of like a house and like the inside of a house. And they were vaguely related to what we saw the last time we were on Chulak like this, but not really all that related. It's like, you know, the set designers and the people had to deal probably with a very low budget for this and just put together whatever they could. And so they did, but there's no wide shots anywhere. Like, we don't see them in the middle of the same kind of places they were in the last time around. And I'm like, yeah, they had to do this in a very low budget, all in sets. And yeah, you know, they did the best they could, but it's just sort of funny that, again, there's this thing that's supposed to be showing him going back to this planet that they've been to before, and they really couldn't show any of it to us. That was interesting.
And of course, there's a secret compartment in the old...
Which is like a church, right?
It's mansion that you have to have, right?
The secret compartment that the Gould are not able, that the Jaffa are not able to see, even though there's some very visible gaps in the wall. Right. Yeah, that's fun. Although at least they're smart enough to actually check the house. Like, I did give them points for actually checking the house, like, more than once. Because, mm-hmm. you know, oh no... Teal'c has returned. Where could he possibly go on the planet? Maybe the house where his wife is?
Yeah.
The only smarter thing would have been to have guards there all the time, which, you know, if they did that, then the episode wouldn't have happened. So I also like, so we did get to see Apophis again, and we get to see that we find out that Apophis is alive, which the previous episodes haven't been that clear on. But, you know, here in this episode, it's like, oh, yes, we had thought that Corel and Apophis were dead. And
we also hear a little bit about Gould politics, yeah. where it's explained that Apophis has lost a lot of credibility and that if he doesn't do something to reassert himself fast, the system lords are going to send a replacement for him, which I don't know would be a demotion for Apophis or if he would die or what. I mean, he would probably resist.
They said they would kill him.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Which would be a demotion.
What I was wondering about that meeting was there the suggestion that they need to save Apophis to make sure he stays in power? Because the devil you know, we should keep a weak Apophis in power because they don't want a new Gould to show up who actually has forces and actual control. Like, it was unclear to me if they were trying to take Apophis down or whether they were trying to prop him up. Because I could see both arguments, and I was a little unsure what their intent was.
No, in that initial meeting, they said the tertiary, the secondary goal is to kill Apophis. The primary goal is to get Ryak and Dreyak out. They say that specifically, which is, as you said, not necessarily the smartest idea tactically, but they did say that's what they were going to do. And then they didn't do any of it. But, you know, they were distracted by the fact that the Ryak mission failed so spectacularly, I suppose. We see Apophis, but we only see him through their equivalent, like, you know, this primitive culture has TVs. I guess everybody's got a TV in their house.
Well, yeah, a one channel transmitter from the boss.
Yeah, it's a very boring TV.
More like a Big Brother thing, I think, than entertainment.
Cool TV, not very exciting.
I had to know that Chulak TV is apparently a Palantir from Lord of the Rings.
Right. Well, this is the same device, smaller, that they were using for communication in the Hatak vessel during the invasion of Earth. Mm-hmm. I like that it was consistent technology for them. But also, you know, Peter Williams, I believe, is the name of the actor who plays Apophis. And, you know, he gets to do all of his scenes for this episode without ever having to coordinate it with the rest of the cast, right? Because he's just doing it on his own. That was funny, too. We get to see him, but we don't get to see him in person.
I did like his propaganda in the broadcast where, you know, I'm a good guy. These traitor rebels need to be found, but I'm really a good guy. See, here's this child of my enemy who is my best worshiper now.
I'd be tempted to call them propaganda balls going forward.
You could go right ahead.
Another aspect of the storyline I really quite like is it does show how the Gould will very frequently try and pick the sneakiest way of getting what they want. Mm. They will apply direct force if they can, but boy, if they can't, they will come up with the most complicated little obscure plan that they can do. And I really quite like them because really, some of them would work. They're pretty good plans.
Mm-hmm. I liked that they revisited the Cassandra Trojan horse.
Yep.
Yes.
And that it gets called out. You know, Jack tells Carter that, hey, remember this? So I enjoyed that. The two teeth thing, I guess, is a little more subtle than the Naquita bomb. I wonder if he has this kind of biological weapon just lying around. I wonder what else he has that he hasn't used and why not. But I also like that it's very simple to release. You know, all Ryak would have had to do on Earth would have been click his teeth a couple of times to, you know, hard enough to break the seal and mix the elements. And So that was a pretty good plan, helped considerably by Teal'c's continuing insistence that his boy is a good boy and he's just strong enough to overcome the conditioning.
Yeah, he was definitely really arrogant and believing in, I have good conditioning, so my son has good conditioning, and you know, he sees right through. I don't think you think what you think is right.
Then again, I've seen plenty of real-life parents who insist that their delinquents are good boys who would never do anything harm, so
yep.
It's not all that unrealistic.
Yeah.
And also, being a parent, you want to take care of your children and want to, you know, assume the best. So, yeah, I mean, I get it. I'm a parent. I understand that, yeah. Still.
It's hard, though, because 3/4 of this episode is all Teal'c being constantly wrong. In my notes I have, this is all Teal'c's fault. Because he's so consistently overreacting and wrong. And he already made the mistakes in Bloodlines. So it was just a little hard to watch this in that regard.
Well, be consoled that there are some episodes where he is allowed to be right, too.
Good.
It's like Thor's chariot in that they do all these wrong things that happen to wind up having the right outcome occur. Like, if they hadn't had the facilities that they have in the SGC, they wouldn't have been able to analyze their teeth and find out what was really wrong with them and know what the threat was. You know, if they hadn't taken him, or if they'd taken him to another planet, you know, he could have killed all the people on another planet.
Mm-hmm.
If they hadn't done this. So it wound up being the right thing. But yeah, they had to make a lot of wrong decisions to get there. I'd also like to sort of a shout out to that actor who plays Ryak, whose name is Neil Dennis. I think he did a good job in this episode. He you know, he was agitated and, you know, he actually has a pretty good sneer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
When we see it, pretty good cool sneer, kind of. So I think they did a good job with him, you know, showing him being brainwashed. And because the episode maybe had some pacing issues with it, like, you know, there were minutes of him acting that way to the camera. And so, you know, and he could do it. He could get away with it without it seeming like fake. I mean, it's all fake, right? But he was not just phoning it in. He was into it, playing that role. I think that's part of what made the episode good, was because he wound up being a good resource for them, a good character, good actor.
There is nothing like your child yelling at you, "You messed up my life." I'm going to have teenagers soon. I'm not looking forward to them acting like this.
Well, they know it all. Just get used to that right now. I'll tell you that.
For Doylist reasons, I perfectly understand why they shipped off Dreok and Ryak at the end of the episode. But in show, I really think they could have made it work. From Watsonian perspectives, I don't see why they would have had to be virtual prisoners forever. Surely they could have educated them so that they could blend in modern society, at least to the point of being able to take field trips and stuff, instead of being virtual prisoners on the base forever.
This is totally making stuff up, but if they wouldn't have gotten permission from higher-ups because Ryak had shown himself to be a threat before, so, you know, they would have said, nope, keep him on the base, or gotta lose. They got rid of him because of those reasons. And I think I said this the last time in Bloodlines, that any other sort of prestige show nowadays with far fewer episodes and much more interaction would have kept them around and had them be part of, you know, schemes and drama on the base with other people, because they would have wanted to use them in enough episodes to make it worthwhile. And SG-1 is part of an older breed of shows where they, nope, we're just going to focus on the main cast and that's going to be it.
I mean, these days, if it were like a Marvel show, they could have a spinoff with a fish out of water sitcom. But that is not this show.
And it also occurred to me that the Land of Light has absolutely no defenses whatsoever. So if the Gua'ul decided to track Ryak down to hurt him further, they would be of absolutely no use in defending him. But yeah.
You just hide him in the dark.
Yeah, that's right. Give him whatever the disease was over there, then no one will recognize him.
The dialogue at the end for making the use of the Zat gun be the solution, I thought actually wasn't that bad. The idea of using ECT, not entirely unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
The risk of using ECT, being they have no idea what effect it would have on the gold inside of Ryak, I thought was pretty reasonable. The fact that it worked seemed a little weak, but it was faster. But just the steps they took to say, well, we know shooting the Zat gun is going to be safe, so let's try that first.
Right.
I thought that was all very defendable. It was a little too easy, a little too fast, but it worked relatively well. Because really, in a prestige show, you'd have this character in this state for multiple episodes as we slowly saw that transition. And that's really what the difference in this type of show, where
yeah.
you're a guest star, which means you get one episode Maybe you'll get another episode. We'll see.
Right. Well, back to Need. Daniel's addiction and recovery was all in the space of one show.
And only shoot Ryak once with the Zat, because any more is not good.
Yeah. Be very careful.
How long do you need to rest before you can get shot again with a Zat gun? Or for the rest of his life, can he only be shot?
I had the same note.
It's probably a D&D long rest.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise by now SG-1 would be dead because they've been shot enough times.
Right.
They've been shot a bunch of times, yeah.
Yeah, it must be a time limit or a recovery period or something.
Long rest is the answer. Yep. Absolutely.
The Stargate SG-1 role-playing game, I'll mention it again, is being released relatively soon for people. So I actually will be very curious if they have the same D&D concepts. They probably do, as things like long rests and stats, and how they will translate that into the Stargate universe. So
it's supposed to be 5e based. So okay. I imagine they'll have some different elements, but a lot of similarities in play.
Yeah.
I also backed the Kickstarter, but I have not had time to look at the PDFs. So I'm just waiting for the physical copies.
Yeah, I read through the PDFs, but I guess we're under NDAs, apparently not to talk about them. So I don't want the company coming after me, so I'm not saying anything.
Right.
On the other hand, maybe we should play it at some point.
Well, it's supposed to be set after season 6, David, so you would have to wait a while.
Yeah, we got a ways to
go. By some definition of we.
Yeah, I actually have a group of people who have been, for whatever reason, have expressed interest in doing this. So I should have reports of it sooner than we get to that. But yes, I would also be happy to try it again, and however long it's going to be before we get to season 6. So,
yep. All right. Anybody have any final thoughts on the episodes?
I just love Master Braytak and his interactions with Hammond of Texas.
The mutual respect is so well communicated.
Yeah, they're both leaders and they both understand and both have that rapport.
Well, when he says, "Do I have leave to enter your compound?" Like, he can't just go back.
But it's polite.
If the answer is no, no,
dial it up. Get him out of here.
Right. You know, pretty good set of episodes, I think, for us. And I had actually not noticed the theme between all of them. That is not why we picked them. We're just sort of picking them in order and going through the whole season one way or another. But yeah, it's nice that it happened that way. And I'm also looking forward to the episodes for our next podcast. Mm-hmm. As well, I think those are going to be a lot of fun, even if the titles do spoil things a bit for David. So, yeah.
I'm okay with that. I don't actually mind spoilers that much.
Yeah.
He knew they'd be coming back eventually, I'm sure.
Presumably, the vast bulk of our listeners are people who have already seen the whole show. They're not listening to us and going, oh, I wonder what happens next, right?
There's value in the pretense.
Yes.
But in terms of, like, I've been in other shows where you were very careful. We tell you when there are spoilers for later things. You know, we're doing that for David, but a little less important for the rest of our listeners, I think, that we worry about them.
As a call out to the audio guide for Babylon 5, I think the structure works fairly well, so I'm still happy with it.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I hope you've enjoyed discussing this with us.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you to the listeners for following along with us. And if you would like to continue the discussion with us, we're on Twitter.
Stargate_SG_fun.
And thank you to all of my co-hosts today. This was another fun discussion.
Happy to be here.
Thanks.
No, thanks. It was fun. Had a good time.
Thanks, Eric, for being here.
Great.
Bye-bye.